to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
As far as Brexit goes, I think the powers that be, mainly in America, but also in Europe and in the UK, are not going to let Brexit happen. They've gone over half a century, 60 years or so, with the EU system, and they're not going to let a lousy populist vote muck up the system that they put together. So I would say the chances of Brexit happening are virtually nil.
But wait, didn't the voters in England decide they wanted out? But wait again, didn't the voters in Greece decide they wanted out too? Our guest this week, a seasoned inside observer of all things political and financial, Stephen Lendman, doesn't give much hope to the idea that the people will really decide what happens next in the UK, or Greece, or for that matter, the US, in its upcoming presidential election. One must ask whether the power of the people is so systemically compromised all over the world by powerful private interests that the very notion of democratic control has become a mere textbook theory. Hello again, I'm Walt McCree, chair of the Public Banking Institute, welcoming you to another edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. The United Kingdom just came through a very telling moment in global democracy when the people actually managed to be heard over the din of media distraction and propaganda. Sort of an aha moment in which the voters' gut-level reckoning transcended the mind-game messaging that was imposed on UK voters by both sides. And the rest is not yet history. Whether the UK or Greece, Puerto Rico or Iceland, or a list of other countries that have been entrained by global financialists, the story is the same. Wherever global capitalists have established functioning platforms, local governments have acquired new masters, the masters of debt. The hands that feed the sweet promise of prosperity through provisions of funds for the needs and visions of the people are the same hands that will patiently wait to acquire their pound of usurious excess, a Faustian bargain universally adopted by people and nations around the globe. As you'll hear from Stephen Lendman today, there isn't much that can be done except to find ways to sever our dependence on the issuance of capital by private banks, that until we democratize our money through creation of publicly owned banks committed to public service, we'll all remain committed to serving the private financial interests to whom we've given that power. This is the nature of 21st century so-called democracy. Trade your time, talent, resources, initiatives, assets for a pittance of cash. Vote, but don't expect an honest result. Listen to the political messaging, but don't believe a word. Perhaps this is a bit too cynical of a take for this 4th of July anniversary, but perhaps it's the perfect time to reflect on how far we haven't come from the historical struggle for our own freedom and independence from Great Britain. It's no big leap to see that we've not come far at all. History hasn't repeated itself. It's remained pretty much the same, while we've been distracting ourselves with a cultural mythology that aggrandizes the notion and trappings of freedom, while ignoring the slavery which binds us all to the true institutional powers that be in the ubiquitous web of debt. Well, now that you're completely bummed out, let's talk about the alternative that lies right in front of us in the form of public banks. Since we now know that banks actually create new money when they make loans, owning our own public mission banks is waiting for us to create them around the country and around the globe and to bring them into play. And there's a lot of that going on around the United States now. Matt Standard reflects later on in the program about how the state of North Carolina has begun to threaten local and regional governments with cutting off funds for infrastructure if they refuse to comply with some harsh new immigration policies that many municipalities object to. As Matt states, it's a reflection of the law that the person with the gold makes the rules, another anti-democratic practice. But let's get back to the Brexit vote, in which a clear majority of British citizens decided they'd be better off without Brussels telling them what to do and how to do it. It was definitely a pushback against the failing fortunes of working-class citizens and a number of other issues that Ellen wrote about this past week.
Well, Ellen, the world has changed since the last time we spoke. I often end our little chats with the question, well, we'll see what happens next. And, wow, what happened next was Britain left the EU. Who'd have thought? Some people seem to have thought that it was likely, and others thought it was no way, and then the speculators were wrong about how that election was going to go. What's happened there?
Well, one problem was that they were complacent that Brexit wouldn't happen because there was a Scottish referendum for Scotland to leave the UK, and that didn't happen. And that polls, which may have been, there was some talk that they were manipulated a bit, but the polls made it look like the leave side was going to win. The exit people had the stronger case by 4%, and they won. But of course, they haven't left yet, and a lot of people say that it will never happen, that there'll be all kinds of pressure, and the news will be saying what a big disaster it is economically to leave, and that they can still change their minds.
We're seeing that right now, aren't we? I mean, like, there's tremendous amount of pushback to say, oh, you guys have made a horrible mistake. I thought it was very interesting to see how strong it was, a pushback. I mean, over here, they're being treated like fools. They didn't have the nerve to leave the UK. What were the issues that you think made people decide to get out?
Well, of course, the immigration was a big one, the fear of immigration or being overrun by competitors for wages and competitors for welfare, that sort of thing. Standing in line at the National Health Service, they blame the immigrants for making the lines longer. So it was largely worker-driven. It was the workers who were dissatisfied. But they were the supporters. But it was driven at the top by a quite right-wing conservative faction that are just not keen to be in the EU anymore, and for good reason. From my view and your point of view, and Richard Werner's point of view, for example, who's a professor at Southampton in the UK, we all think they should be leaving because the EU is sort of a totalitarian CIA setup from the start. But from their point of view, they've been in it a long time. They've got business deals that will fall through. The banks won't be in the same position as before. And, of course, banking has always been their biggest business, or certainly in the City of London, which voted for Remain. And there are concerns about that they'll get pushback from the EU, that there'll be retribution. And so there are all kinds of practical considerations. The property values will probably drop in London. People are worried about that. But looking at the big picture the way we do, because here we are sitting on the other side of the ocean, seems like a good thing. Anyway, it's a step for change, and we all know it takes good crisis to trigger a change. What I just wrote about in my latest article was one change that it has triggered, or one concern, is that Italy already has bankrupt banks now, and they've already seeking a bailout for their banks. And they're using Brexit as the excuse, although the banks were insolvent to start with. So it does look like it was just an excuse to change the rules, because bailouts are no longer allowed without first doing bail-ins, which means you've got to take the creditor's money and the depositor's money, or a portion of it. And just the threat of bail-ins has backfired on the Italian banks, because the investors have fled knowing that that could happen. And the depositors have fled. So the banks are bankrupt in part because of these measures that were designed to save the banks have actually hurt the banks. Plus, you know, increased capital requirements hurts the banks, because that means they've got to get more investors, and they can make fewer loans because they have to hold more money back for capital. So what I wrote about was an article I read that I thought was very interesting. Why is it that they can't just write down the debt of all these sovereign governments or renegotiate it?
Right.
It's because there is $100 trillion in debt, sovereign debt, and there are $500 trillion, more than $500 trillion, in derivatives riding on that sovereign debt. And they use the bonds, the sovereign bonds, as collateral for these derivatives. So you know, you have to post some collateral, a portion of what you're going to have to pay if you lose the bet in order to play the derivatives game. And if the collateral goes bad, if those bonds go bad, then they'll have to come up with new collateral. And there is no new collateral. They don't have any more. They're already short on bonds and short on collateral, and the banks don't have anywhere to go. Of course, the derivatives game is largely a banker's game, and they don't have any place to get this extra collateral.
Mm.
So that could trigger a collapse of this big derivatives domino, which it is thought it would bring down all the banks, or all the big banks,
yeah,
and basically bring down the economy once again. It would be 2008 all over again, but
much
worse this time. Yeah.
Yeah, much bigger, yeah. They don't want to give a break on any of the debt to countries like Italy and Greece and Cyprus and Puerto Rico and Argentina and Brazil. I mean, you know, the list. They don't want to do that because they lose their profit, right? They lose their whole investment.
Well, and also because it'll trigger the derivatives thing, which...
Which is the linchpin upon which their game is, in fact, the game
built,
that we live in is built, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very interesting.
So,
well,
so what I was suggesting, of course, I always like to write the positive solution or the what we make of this or how you can fix it. They're really forced because they can't renegotiate or write down the debt. Bail-ins aren't working. Bailouts are means the governments have to step in with the money, and that's not allowed. And that they may allow bailouts in Italy. We don't know. But what they could do, or what they no doubt will do, at least to some extent, is to have the ECB buy back the bonds themselves.
The European Central Bank.
Yeah, the central bank with money created on a computer screen. But then what they do, just like with our QE, quantitative easing, is they hold the bonds on the books of the central bank. So it still looks like the government is in debt, heavily in debt, and therefore they're supposed to try to balance their budget, pay off the debt, and so they don't have the money for all those social programs and infrastructure and the things that people expect government to do. They don't have the money for that. They have to do cutbacks, privatize their public assets, and so forth. So they could be freed up to spend again if the central bank would not just buy back the debt, but actually void out the debt after they bought it back. The argument against that is that it would trigger hyperinflation, but my argument is that it wouldn't. I would love to be able to design a computer program or a computer game or something to prove this, but we now know that all money is created, or virtually 97% of the money supply is created by banks when they make loans, and it's created and destroyed all day, every day by banks. So there is no fixed money supply, as people think. So it's just a question of who creates that money. But anyway, so you've got people hold on to bonds, their accounts, whatever, their savings accounts. They've got these bonds that they count as money, and they're counted as near money in the money supply because they're so liquid that you can immediately turn them into cash. So if you've got your these bonds in your account, say in your savings account, and suddenly they get cashed out, and instead of whatever, $5,000 worth of a U.S. savings bond, you've got $5,000 cash, you're not going to rush out and spend that cash. You know, if you didn't want to spend it before, the reason you put it in bonds was that you wanted to save it. So you might invest it in something else, but that's not going to drive up consumer prices. It might drive up the stock market, but so what? The stock market is just a big casino in the first place, and it doesn't matter at what level the prices are when you get in. The idea is you want to get in at some price and sell at a higher price, and that's the gamble that people take when they play the stock market. The money doesn't go back to the company.
Yeah, and that's the nature of the whole economic system, is it's just about constantly inflating profits and margins and profits and margins, and when it's now way past the point where it's tied into anything of solid value, and the game has run out of oxygen. So you're suggesting, well, you know, stick a pin in it, you know, deflate the fabrication, pay off the bonds.
Yeah, well, and if you pay out the bonds with cash, that's real money in the system. That's what it should have been in the first place. Instead of issuing bonds, the government should have issued cash to pay for the things it needs. That's where government or money should come from. Right now, it comes from banks when they make loans, but then it doesn't go into productive things. It goes into all this financialization, as you were mentioning. So it's what we want it to go into is infrastructure and public services. We know we've got the workers out there, we've got the materials out there, we've got bridges falling apart, but we can't get the workers and the materials together to build the bridges because we don't have those green pieces of paper called money.
Yeah.
We have plenty of those pink pieces of paper called bonds, so let's turn the pink paper into green paper and we'll suddenly have the money and fix the problem.
Just like Thomas Edison said about Henry Ford, right?
Yeah, exactly.
What's the difference here? Well, it's going to be interesting to see how the politics plays out. The people, the will of the people, obviously, having been spoken very clearly over and against even the pollsters. It will be very interesting to see what kind of propaganda is issued and how much fear is generated to keep that Brexit vote from being realized. But the aspect of contagion of other countries, like Italy, as you mentioned, but, you know, Greece, too, seems to me to be in line. Didn't they just extend more credit to Greece? As Michael Hudson said, if you can't repay the debt, it's not going to be repaid.
Right. They're extending credit, which puts them further into debt. What they should do is buy back the debt with real money. That would be helpful, and it wouldn't hurt any creditors. It wouldn't actually hurt the ECB. If they can do quantitative easing the way they're doing it, they can do it as helicopter money or people's QE.
It's a strange time, but we will just hang in and see what happens next.
Right. Interesting times.
Interesting times. Stay tuned and tie yourself down.
Right.
Securely. All right, Ellen. Thanks very much for this, and we look forward to hearing what Stephen Landman has to say about this. He's got some very, very expansive views about how this Brexit thing fits into global peace and security, so I'm looking forward to your conversation with him next.
Okay, great. Great talking.
Thanks, Ellen.
My guest today is Stephen Landman, a prolific writer and formerly a syndicated columnist, news TV personality, and radio show host. He has written a number of books, the latest of which, as editor and contributor, is called Flashpoint in Ukraine, U.S. Drive for Hegemony Risks World War III, a rather ominous title. So, greetings, Stephen. It's so great to be talking to you.
Oh, well, it's certainly wonderful talking to you. I must say, I would not call myself a former writer. I'm certainly a very active writer, and I truly love it. It gives me a reason for getting up each day.
Yep, I know. It gets me up each day, whether I want to or not. So, speaking of being prolific, we had this bombshell Brexit vote on June 23rd, and you've actually written 19 articles on it. I've managed to squeak out one in that time. So that's what I wanted to talk about today was Brexit and your thoughts about it. You obviously have lots of thoughts about it. But the first article that I saw, you said that it wasn't actually binding and you questioned whether it would really go through. Maybe we should say, so Brexit is Britain leaving the EU, which was very controversial and quite close vote. Scotland voted to stay in, and Northern Ireland.
I believe they voted to stay in as well.
Stay in, yeah. Wales
and Londoners voted
out
to stay in, and I guess in the hinterlands came the big opposition vote.
So it's very controversial, and I actually have friends in the UK who wanted to stay, even though we're looking at it from a distance, and we think they're better off out of the EU because it's it's pro-bank, pro-austerity, not good for the people in Southern Europe. It's, you know, there's the NATO issue, all those things. But for my friends in the UK, the reason I don't want to come out too strongly in favor of Brexit or be too triumphant about all this is that they're suffering the immediate effects, or they're worried about the immediate effects that, you know, trade or business deals will fall through, the banks are losing business and will probably move, the pound is going down, that sort of thing. So they're worried about immediate things. Property values will probably go down in London. So anyway, do you want to talk about why you think it might not go through? It seems to me the push right now is try to get a reversal of this opinion.
I am really astonished that this thing passed. My strong feeling was, I think along with probably all the insiders was, it was a done deal. Brexit is going down. It's never going to be passed. And I honestly believe that the election was rigged to see to it that Brexit failed, that the actual support for Brexit, I believe, was a lot stronger than it showed up in the 52-48 margin. So my feeling is that even though the powers thought they rigged the thing against Brexit, they didn't rig it well enough.
Uh-huh.
they screwed up, and Brexit won. And the question is, what's next? Well, go back to the 1950s, and the CIA had its dirty hands all over creating the EU, the idea being that it's a lot easier for America to control a single entity than to have to deal individually with sovereign nations. Being part of a union means you give up a lot of your political sovereignty. Being part of the Eurozone system, that the monetary system, I think it's 19 countries in there now. When I wrote a lot about it before it was 18, I think there was a 19th added. They give up their monetary and fiscal authority to the greater authority in Brussels, and the EU countries, 28 of them. Still 28, but still in the EU. If they leave, it's 27, but still 28. They give up their political authority to Brussels. And to me, this makes no sense at all. I am a strong supporter, Ellen, of sovereign independence, and no one will ever get me to change my feeling on that.
Right. Well, interestingly enough, this is Independence Day weekend for 4th
yes.
of July for the U.S., and it seems to me that's pretty much what the U.K. has done. They've started a revolution, whether they want to or not. I mean, I'm sure many people were opposed to the American Revolution because it was going to be pretty stressful on the Americans. So it's very bold of them to plunge into this.
It really is incredible. Of course, none of this would have happened if it hadn't been for the Clinton-Glass-Steagall in this whatchamacallit, Monetarization Act, opened up the avenue for this derivatives explosion, and this is what we have now. So, you know, I mean, it just keeps getting bigger and bigger and worse, Ellen. You know, you have to wonder, where does this thing end? What can't go on forever won't, and at some point, you know, they can keep their finger in the dike, but at some point, this whole thing just has to explode in some way, and the longer you wait, my feeling is the worse it's going to get.
So, among other things that you've written about is the NATO aspect of the EU. So what do you think? It's liable to trigger World War III. It looks like we're pushing for World War III. We're making Russia out to be this great enemy that the EU has to put aside 2% of their budget in order to build up a military force supposedly against Russia, which is really would be their friend or used to be their friend. So what do you think the effect of the UK leaving the EU will have on NATO, if anything?
Well, of course, you mentioned the fact that, you know, you do things during a crisis you can't do other times. And Roosevelt in the 1930s, of course, his main aim was to save capitalism, not be a good guy. But in the process, he was a good guy. We got the New Deal. We got Social Security. We got Glass-Steagall. We got a lot of good stuff. And what's happening now, the crisis since the dot-com bubble in 2000, all the bad stuff happened now. So we get austerity. We get all the rest of it. So now we have another crisis. You never know it from the last four trading days on the world stock markets, up and away. I guess maybe that happens ahead of holidays. But Brexit, I mean, two days of mayhem on the markets, then all of a sudden the world is calm and peaceful again. Well, that makes no sense to me whatsoever. So you take advantage of a crisis to do these horrible things, maybe greater austerity than before, maybe more wars than before. I absolutely feel we're heading for a confrontation with Russia and China. I don't see it happening right now, but I wrote an article this morning on hacked General Breedlove emails, the former NATO head who retired officially the 1st of July, and his emails have been hacked, some of them at least, the essence of which he was pushing important current and former military officials, think tank officials, other government officials, to push the Obama administration toward igniting a conflict with Russia. He talked about a proxy conflict, but you know, you start a little spark and it can turn into a bomb fire. I mean, you have to be a lunatic to think like this, but I honestly believe the neocons that infest Washington want a war with Russia, they want a war with China. These two countries are the last frontier to give them complete dominion over planet Earth and everything that goes on, the big stuff, the financial stuff, political stuff, monetary stuff, control it all. And guys like Breedlove out of it, his successor, from what I can tell, is just as hawkish as he is. And even though he's out of NATO and retired from the military, he's using his influence to incite conflict with Russia. It's scary, Ellen. It is very, very scary. As far as Brexit goes, I think the powers that be, mainly in America, but also in Europe and in the UK, are not going to let Brexit happen. They've gone half a century, over half a century, 60 years or so, with the EU system, and they're not going to let a lousy populist vote muck up the system that they put together. So I would say the chances of Brexit happening are virtually nil, Ellen. We've got all this turmoil going on. They're going to use it to do the stuff they want to do. They'll keep the pot boiling for I don't know how long. If you go through the Brexit process, you invoke the so-called Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty affecting the EU. It's never been done before. I don't think it's going to be done now. And even if it is done, I think they'll manipulate the process to see that the thing goes down. And there are so many ways they can defeat this thing. There could be a major false flag in Europe of the nature of a 9/11, scaring people so much to believe that this is a time for unity, not division. Or they could threaten people with the risk from China and Russia that does not exist. And again, using anything they want to bring up to convince people that unity is the answer to these problems, and disunity lets the bad guys win, stuff like that. And this is what I see happening. And the first shot across the bow was Boris Johnson, the former London mayor, the front runner to be the next prime minister in October when the Tories hold their annual conference, and he drops out. He was way ahead in the polls as of now, and he drops out, a fervent Brexit backer. The fact that he dropped out makes me think the whole thing is rigged to make sure Brexit never happens.
Yeah, it looked like the reason he was encouraged to drop out was it was said that he wouldn't be able to unify the Leaves and the Remains, so that it would be like a contentious government. But I agree with you. It looks like the real reason was they want to reverse that decision. And if they have somebody in as prime minister who vigorously believes that Brexit was the right thing to do, they're going to have a hard time getting this decision reversed.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
Then there's the fact of Jeremy Corbyn is taking a lot of heat over it.
But I think the name of the game is to do things, probably more than one, to convince British voters that maybe the idea of Brexit wasn't such a good one in the first place.
Yeah.
So they'll shift the majority from the pro-camp to the anti-camp. And I think that's the way they're going to manipulate the system, rather than just the powers coming down and saying, the hell with you. We don't care what you want. You can't really do that. You know, people in Europe are a lot more excitable than they are in America. Americans protest for a day, and then they go back and watch a ball game. And Britain, look what's happening in France right now. Since March, people are so angry about this anti-labor legislation, they refuse to quit. My hat's off to the Frenchmen.
What do you think are the chances that Brexit would trigger other populist movements that would actually work, like Italy, for example, which is already calling for concessions, changes in the rules, so that they can write off some of their debt?
There was a Pew Research study done, but it showed the possibility of contagion, that this thing could happen in other countries. Now there's a big chasm between activists for the exiting camp launching a campaign and something actually happening to see to it that the exit happens. I think the strongest feeling for exit is in France, which would be called a Frexit if it happens. But the strong sentiment in Italy, I think very strong against it, surprisingly, was in Poland. I'm trying to remember everything that was in the article. They polled the 10 most significant EU countries, 28 EU countries in total. They polled 10 of them. There was an awful lot of pro-Brexit sentiment in all of them, in some countries a lot more than others. But it's absolutely true. You light the fire, and it can spread to other countries. But there's a big difference between starting the campaign for something and actually having an exit take place. I don't think any of these countries will exit the EU, and I think it'll be manipulated in all of them to see it doesn't happen. But there could be a lot of turmoil along the way, Ellen.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about rewriting some of the rules? I wonder what the possibilities are. Of the one I always write about, the fact that the central bank, the ECB, can make low-interest loans, like our central bank does, to banks, but not to governments. So here's a central bank that's obviously there to serve the banks. The governments, meanwhile, have to borrow. I think at one point Greece was borrowing at 30%, you know, whatever the market will bear, and you can have short sales and all sorts of speculators that come in and drive up your interest rates. So definitely their banking rules need to be changed in order to allow some liquidity and productivity in those countries, but it looks like the intent is to force them into austerity, privatization, force all these hordes of immigrants that will change their cultures so they don't have this strong cultural bias. You no longer have the sense of I'm an Italian or whatever if half the people there aren't really Italian.
There's a very simple way to stop the refugee crisis, and that's to stop the wars, Ellen. I mean, these refugees are coming from the wars, Syria, the big one, of course, but also Afghanistan, from Libya, from Iraq, and that's where most of these people are coming from. They're fleeing to save their lives. And
right.
If you stop the wars, you'll stop the crisis. The whole thing will be solved. But they don't look at it that way. You know, they want to put them in concentration camps, stuff them in Turkey or some crazy island someplace, and treat them worse than they were at home. I think a significant number of people have gotten so disgusted they would prefer going home and living in a war zone.
I think one reason that Brexit passed and everybody was surprised about it was that it couldn't be rigged, that they have a system where they actually had physical vote counters, you know, people who were counting paper ballots, whereas our votes definitely can be rigged. And it looked like the polls were rigged, and they were probably rigged because the idea was if you saw the polls and you thought, oh, you know, Brexit was, there's no chance for that, you would just vote against it. But in fact, what they didn't realize was how many people actually supported it. That, I mean, everybody thought, well, there was a Scottish referendum and they didn't, it was voted down. Of course, this one will be voted down too. Nobody's going to shake the boat that much, but they actually did.
But where there's a will, there's a way, Ellen. I think if they want to rig it, they can find a way. They just pay off the vote counters. I don't know what they would do. But I think the way they'll do it going forward is create incidents to change the public mind. You manipulate public opinion, and that's the most effective way. If you can get people to go along with what you want to do, no muss, no fuss. You don't have to send the tanks into the streets.
And you've also written some about on the political situation in the U.S., and one difference, of course, is that we have a two-party system, and there just doesn't seem to be any chance of a third party breaking in, where at least in the EU, they do have the possibility of third parties having some influence. So how are you seeing the political scene in the U.S. right now in terms of the TPP, corporate control, banking, the things that we focus on in this?
Oh, program. One quick comment about Europe, and we can get into the U.S. a little bit, Ellen. Indeed, they have multiple parties in Europe, and we saw it in Greece, where the outlier Syriza party defeated the mainstream party, the supposed populist party, Syriza. And when we talk about referendums enacted by the people going one way and the politicians going another way, it goes back some months now, but the Syriza government put a vote to the people, let the people vote by referendum on whether they were for or against the most recent budget cuts that were on the table that Brussels wanted. And a huge majority, I forget the exact percent, I think it was over 60%, voted against the budget cuts. And Syriza simply forgot about it and made them anyway. So you can have a referendum. People can go one way, and the politicians can go the other way. In America, Ellen, I say we have a one-party state. We have duopoly rule with two wings, I don't see any difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. There were differences years ago. I mean, if you go back to the New Deal, there were major differences. Republicans and Democrats were vastly different from each other, although very similar in supporting capitalism. But Republicans would never have enacted Social Security or Medicare under Lyndon Johnson, things like that. I mean, these are important things. You'd never see either party going for things like this. When you get neoliberal austerity, you can see that both parties are in the same boat on simply handing wealth to people, super rich people and corporations, and taking it from ordinary people. So we see America being third worldized. I see America being turned into Guatemala.
Well, to me, the flaw is in the financial system, the fact that we've allowed banks to create all of our money instead of governments. And so government really has been drowned in a bathtub, so that these big corporate interests that we think we need in order to borrow from, in order to get our money, they are in control. We need to change that system. But then the question is, even if people are convinced that that's the correct thing to do and that that would fix the system, like you say, if voter initiatives don't work, then how do we get back control?
Well, you and I are great supporters of public banking. It's the only way to go. I don't see any possibility for democracy, even in the slightest form, unless we can get public banking, Ellen. I think you would agree. But there'll never be a referendum where it's left to the people to decide, do you want this or you don't want it? I think if you ask people, took a poll on the street and asked people questions about public banking, you would see profound ignorance. People just have no idea what this is, whether it's good, bad, or otherwise. Don't you agree?
Yeah, I do. And you were talking about the push to take on Russia and China, which seems insane. But actually, from their point of view, I think maybe they're desperate, and that's what they have to do, because China and Russia have the better system. I think that's why they took on the Islamic countries, the Middle Eastern countries, that they were actually issuing their own money. The central bank was actually serving the government, which was serving the people. I mean, the model would have been Libya, where the central bank funded all sorts of projects that they, you know, they gave money to, like, newlyweds. It was an interest-free system. Gaddafi was attempting to get all of Africa to join in this system where they would step out of the Western banking system and form their own system with their own currency, which is gold-backed. So it's a real threat to the Western financial system, which is totally banker-issued money at interest, which is mathematically not viable in the end. I mean, you always wind up with this huge debt overhang that you can't pay, and then you've got to force people into austerity in order to try to get that paid. In other words, their system is actually more viable than ours. And the only way that those people in control of our system can maintain control is they almost have to go to war. That's what they think.
Oh, I absolutely agree, Ellen. There's no question. Libya, I think, is the classic example. 2011, when the U.S.-led NATO war was raging, I wrote volumes on Libya. I mean, the war destroyed Africa's most developed country, and all the wonderful benefits that Americans can't even imagine that Gaddafi gave to the Libyan people. Small country, oil wealth. It was a wonderful combination for the people living there, and now all they have is turmoil, death, destruction, violence, a complete mess. And it was well known this would happen when the war began. And Saddam in Iraq, Gaddafi was no dictator. Saddam was a dictator, but he was the kind of dictator you could live under as long as you didn't go after him. And he had his own money and provided wonderful benefits to the Iraqi people, and that's all gone. And the system in Syria, certainly not a dictatorship, authoritarian, but it's become much more democratic and since the war began.
There's an awful lot of misperception, it seems to me. And I mean, we're probably the most brainwashed country in the world overall. Most people don't peer into things the way we do, you and I, and probably anybody who listens to this radio show. They turn on this. I used to do this when I was a busy lawyer and mother, you know, and couldn't possibly get all my chores done. I would turn on the news, you know, 5 minutes, I'd catch the top of the news, and that was what I knew about what was going on in the world, and I just took their word for it. I mean, my goal was to get the names down so I didn't sound like an idiot at dinner.
Oh, I agree. And I mean intelligent people who simply don't know anything about what's going on. I'm astonished at the level of ignorance. They'll, you know, if they get news at all, they'll turn on the TV set, which is the easiest thing to do. The only time I look at the mainstream media on television is to give me something to want to write about, you know, just smash them over the head with. But I usually don't go to television for that. I look at the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, my favorite three punching bags. The New York Times, absolutely number one. I know those people in the newspapers know me because I've slammed them so many times.
I do all my research on the net. I don't watch TV either.
That's exactly what I do, and I've told people so often. I mean, you and I grew up before there was an internet. I mean, I grew up before there was any television. We didn't have television in my home until I was, I think, a sophomore in high school.
A little re-listen to the radio. I remember this great big old radio that played, I think it was The Shadow or something like that.
The Shadow and Superman and Captain Midnight and Terry and the Pirates. I love that stuff, Ellen.
Yeah. Well, we're kind of getting to the end here, but did you want to just say something about the American political scene versus the European, you know, just the fact that we have a two-party system, and is there any hope for any third-party candidates, and what's going on with Bernie Sanders supporters, half of them sort of defecting?
I think Clinton was chosen to be the next president. Maybe not when the campaign began, because if a Republican other than Trump had been picked, then maybe that person would have been favored. But I think the Republican candidates were so deplorable that Trump, helped by his unorthodox anti-establishment sounding style, and of course there's no such thing as an anti-establishment billionaire, just doesn't exist, but he came across sounding that way, so he emerged the victor, and then I think it was a done deal that Clinton is going to be the next president, and they will rig the election for her. But I've got an article that I'll get out later today showing that almost half of Sanders supporters will not support Clinton in a Trump-Clinton race, which is the way it's going to be. And a certain percentage will go to the Libertarian Party, a certain percentage will go to Trump, some will go to the Green Party. Well, you could look at the polls now, and most of them, maybe all of them, show Clinton ahead. The latest Wall Street Journal NBC poll showed in a four-party race, if it were held today or if it were held last week when the poll came out, Clinton would be ahead of Trump by one percentage point, meaning it's a dead heat. But if it's a dead heat, it'll be rigged to see that Clinton wins. But if half of Sanders supporters do not support her and a good chunk of them go to Trump, then they could try to rig it and it could come out in favor of Trump and he could win. So I think we need to monitor this very closely, which I will do, and just keep an eye out on how things develop. If Trump stays within a few percentage points of Clinton, even though I think Clinton is going to win because I think it'll be rigged for her, Trump has already surprised once, and he could do it again. I despise them both, but I'll say very candidly, if it comes to a choice between the two, Trump hands down, I would pick. I would deplore a Trump presidency, but if Clinton wins and succeeds Obama, I consider World War III a coin flip, 50-50. She's a Putin hater. She's a Russia hater. I think she's a China hater, and you have to ignore what these people say on the stump. I would like to, though, you know, she won't release the speeches she's made to corporations. One of the speeches she made to Wall Street, to Goldman Sachs, I don't know who got a hold of it. I guess it was hacked, and I wrote an article about it a few months ago, maybe 4 or 5 months ago. Oh, the opposite of the stuff that she says. I mean, just praising the dickens out of Goldman Sachs, and you know, like the head of Goldman Sachs saying he does God's work. Well, Clinton, in her own words, basically saying the same thing, and get paid a few $100,000 for saying something like that. She won't release the speeches she makes to corporations because, of course, she supports them and she's getting all this money. But I'm really scared if she becomes president. We've seen successive administrations, each worse than the preceding one, and if Clinton becomes the next president, I think we really could find ourselves in a terrible debacle with the possibility of a third world war. And with the kind of weapons we have today, Ellen, that's something we should all be all very, very scared about.
We do live in frightening times, but then it's when things are critical that things change on the optimistic side.
I hope things turn out okay, but I'm very, very worried.
Those are very interesting observations. Yeah. Well, it's been great talking to you. Do you want to give your website and any other details about how people can find you?
My blog site, which I originally set up only to keep my articles in chronological order, anybody can find it the way I do. Simply Google my last name, Lendman, L-E-N-D-M-A-N. Not many Lendmans around, and you'll find it very easily, and all my articles are there.
Oh, great. Well, it's been so nice talking to you.
Ellen, thank you so much. It really is a joy being on with you.
I've been speaking with Stephen Lendman, a writer and columnist and radio talk show host whose latest book is called Flashpoint in Ukraine, U.S. Drive for Hegemony Risks World War III.
Well, you know, this is pretty heavy stuff, and maybe it's just time to take a little bit of a lighthearted break. Here's a repeat performance of a little ditty that might stick with you for a few hours after you hear it, celebrating the prospect of having your own bank.
California's a failure because we haven't got a bank.
Well, what would you do with a bank if you had one?
Dude, if California had a bank?
We could rightly use what's ours to cultivate the flowers and clean our septic tank. We could trade unemployment for service and enjoyment if we only had a bank. When we're stuck and need some credit and Wall Street says forget it, we won't be in the tank. We could pass on lesser offers, borrow cash from our own coffers if we only had a bank. Oh, why? Tell me why. We're sinking lower than we've sunk before, and all the jobs, they've gone offshore. We can stimulate production, construction, and instruction by standing for this plank. Just 11 million voters will be like North Dakota, we'll finally have a bank. If we get up off our assets and get the folks to pass it, we'll finally have a bank. A bank.
Feigning the financial tin man is Steve Behrman from California, talking about creating their own public bank.
I'm Matt Stannard with the Public Banking Report. And today, our subject is politics. Dirty politics to an extent. Dirty infrastructure politics, with and without Wall Street. I also have a clean alternative, as you can imagine, and I'm guessing you know what it is. Infrastructure politics, because nothing is more political than infrastructure. Our elected officials live with a myth of fiscal scarcity. They assume that there's only so much money, and that when something is scarce, you fight over it. And because it's infrastructure, roads, bridges, transportation, shipping facilitation, airports, seaports, etc., we all desperately need it. So everyone needs it, everyone is convinced we can't afford to pay for it. It's dirty politics because powerful public and private officials play games with it. Public officials threaten to withhold assistance, funding, general improvements, necessary new projects. They may not shut down tunnel lanes like people in Chris Christie's administration did, but they may threaten to withhold funding to ensure cooperation with other policies, a common federal tactic as well, threatening local control via fund disbursement power. Which brings us to the state of North Carolina. The recent news that the State House of Representatives there voted 81-27, a bipartisan margin, to scrap a deal to build a section of Interstate 77 as a toll road may not come as a huge surprise. The toll road was, after all, a bad deal. A public-private partnership for construction, the kind where private investors expect 15-20% returns on their investment, including interest and fees. That's your typical Wall Street and shareholder mentality. Eves Smith, writing for Naked Capitalism, compares it to selling the family china and then renting it back in order to eat. But still, we're left asking, If the House isn't willing to spend that money, where is North Carolina going to come up with the money to spend? What are they going to do about Interstate 77? Just let it crumble? While you chew on that question for a while, let me continue with the story of how that same legislature is using infrastructure funds itself as a weapon. In addition to voting to tear up the I-77 contract, North Carolina House also this year passed HB 100. HB 100 refuses to recognize the identifications issued by local cities for immigrants and instead requires that everyone possess the same state-issued ID. It mandates that court clerks record and publicly disclose the legal status of those asking to be excused from jury duty, and it enforces all of this by, that's right, threatening to remove infrastructure funding for local governments that don't comply. That funding could be withheld for multiple years. Regardless of how you feel about immigration law, it's troubling that a state has the power to physically threaten local governments. North Carolina, like most states, struggles with ongoing disrepair of its roads and bridges. Over 2,000 bridges in that state need repair. And the state has over 1,000 miles of waterways and 46 miles of levees. A dispute between state and local government could turn into a death sentence for an innocent resident or traveler of North Carolina, all over an issue wholly unrelated to infrastructure. And state and federal governments do this all the time, hang the threat of infrastructure funding over the heads of local governments. Well, I speculated earlier that you knew what my solution would be, and you were right. Municipal public banks, capitalized and financed by a city or county's own tax receipts and other accumulated money, could use the power of public fractional reserve banking to fund scaled infrastructure repairs and projects, just as a state-owned bank could fund that I-77 development. Studying the Bank of North Dakota, the nation's only public bank, one is struck by the potential independence of such entities. State oversight doesn't have to mean state political control. In the case of North Carolina and so many other states, local public banks offer the potential of balancing political power between state and local control. That's important when you have legislatures like North Carolina, which, as we all know, have been acting a little heavy-handed over the last year. Wall Street shouldn't gamble with people's lives, and state governments shouldn't either. It's time to move from the paradigm, whoever has the gold makes the rules, to we can make the rules together according to what works. And decentralized, democratized finance is one great way to get there. After all, it's our money. This is Matt Stannard saying drive carefully.
On today's What Wall Street Costs America, a look at our neighbors and fellow citizens in Puerto Rico. From a short film by Brave New Films, we take a look at how Wall Street hedge funds are destroying people's lives for the sake of gaining outrageous profits. And as you'll see, the report describes the realities of what we've been talking about here on It's Our Money, about what Wall Street and the global financialists are doing to communities and countries around the world.
Vulture hedge funds are profiting off of Puerto Rico's debt crisis, and people are literally dying because of Wall Street greed. The American Commonwealth of Puerto Rico is in a serious debt crisis. Many are not able to get the medical care they need because U.S. hedge funds are using their political leverage to get maximum profits before Puerto Rico pays their doctors and hospitals. And everyday citizens are paying the ultimate price.
It is a big issue. They can die.
Unfortunately, my uncle suffered a stroke. When they made the recommendation to see a neurologist, there were only two available on the island that day.
I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. I'm an internationally known salsa dancer. It messes with your speech, your vision. It just completely changes your life.
The Puerto Rican people are in a desperate situation, and that's exactly what vulture hedge funds are looking for.
Including Blue Mountain Capital.
Blue Mountain Capital.
Andrew Feldstein at Blue Mountain Capital made our top 100 richest hedge funds in the world.
Vulture hedge funds like Andrew Feldstein's Blue Mountain Capital get their name by identifying desperate economies so they can buy up debt and bonds for a fraction of the true value.
And then squeeze every last drop out of their debtors.
They did it in Detroit, Argentina, and Greece. Now they're targeting Puerto Rico. Blue Mountain Capital owns $400 million of bonds issued by the island's energy company, PREPA. PREPA tried to restructure its debt in order to stay operational, but Blue Mountain immediately sued Puerto Rico to make sure the hedge fund was paid first.
Puerto Rico's debt problem has gotten so dire, the power authority cut off a hospital that's behind on its bill.
They're closing a hospital in Guayama. They were unable to pay their electric bill, so the electric company ordered to shut down the hospital. You have people who are responsible for healing sick people, and they're being laid off.
We have lost about 5,000 jobs. In order to reduce costs, we closed this particular ward over here and the one on the other side as well.
You talk to the staff here at the hospital, and it's heartbreaking. They can only get medicine to treat children with cancer if they pay cash in advance.
You know, when we look at what we've built at Blue Mountain, we're proud across the board of our performance. Very excited about the opportunities for a long time to come.
Vulture funds are demanding to receive an estimated 244% profit before the Puerto Rican government is able to fund public health services like Medicaid.
The financial crisis has affected all of us. One government agency can't pay the hospital. Hospital can't pay suppliers, and you don't get enough equipment to treat patients. Hospitals close floors. Hospitals close down.
I have Medicare, but I can't find a doctor.
It doesn't stop there. Puerto Rico is losing a doctor a day.
There is a wait list for several specialties. The waiting period is just more than 4 months. And if we keep losing physicians, then it's an issue now.
The doctor doesn't deal with MS patients anymore. Recommends another doctor. I call that doctor, no answer.
My uncle, when the stroke occurred, he was supposed to have gotten care on Friday. He didn't get it until Tuesday or Wednesday. The next week. Died about 4 days later.
Estimates indicate that vulture funds will make upwards of $15 billion no matter when they get paid. But they are demanding profits before the health and safety of Americans in Puerto Rico.
We have hospitals that don't have electricity. With no action, you're going to have chaos on the island.
Puerto Rico is in real trouble.
These vulture funds have lived up to their name. Puerto Ricans have been suffering the effects of savage government cuts.
Some of the hedge funds that are actually right now own some of this debt are the same ones that own some of the Argentinian debt, and they got their payoff.
3.5 million Americans are facing a dire crisis right now, and the clock is ticking.
We don't win what we don't fight for. So let's stand up to the hedge funds and let's fight for our brothers and sisters in Puerto Rico.
It's time to hold hedge fund vultures accountable for what they're doing in Puerto Rico, the States, and throughout the world. Call Andrew Feldstein. Ask him, how many more billions do you need to stop pillaging Puerto Rico?
If you want to call Andrew Feldstein, that number is 212-905-3900. 212-905-3900. Our thanks to Brave New Films for their powerful film called Praying on Puerto Rico, Forgotten Citizens of Hedge Fund Island, which you can find on bravenewfilms.org. We thank them for this contribution to What Wall Street Costs America. Well, that's it for this week's edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests and to our sponsor, Payment Management, a merchant payment processing company dedicated to economic fairness and justice. Payment Management invites you to receive a free analysis of your card processing needs and costs. More information is available at paymentmgmt.com. Be sure to stay in touch with the ongoing conversations around what's going on in our world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with